Exodus chapter 3, beginning at verse 1. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses, he said, here I am. Then he said, do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I've come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me. I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? He said, but I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. Then Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. And we'll stop there because of time. We often say at the London Bridge Talks that what we hope to do is explain the Christian faith, help people understand what is reality, the reality of sinners who have been reconciled to a holy God. Jesus Christ is the means by which sinners can be reconciled to the living God. And Christians are those who have, by faith in Jesus, entered into that reality. And having done so, having been reconciled, this vast life opens up in which we know the eternal God. We have relationship with the Lord who spoke here in our text to Moses in history. Christians are those who know the Lord God. I first gave this talk quite recently. Lots of you, I think probably all of you, know about Mikey, the news that was broken a few weeks ago now of a terminal tumor. And this, by God's providence, happened to be the passage that we were looking at the next Sunday. And we did so. And it was a very helpful passage for us as we considered it. Through our time in Exodus, God has kept us, those who know Mikey well. And the reason Christians hold fast through the fiercest of storms is because the God with whom we have met, the holy God, the only God, this God who we meet in Exodus, is both ever-present with his people and all-sufficient for his people. That is why Christians continue to trust in God. And that's what we're going to be considering today. I hope it will help you to know this God who is ever-present. Something like that. The whole thing is set as this bush is aflame, burning away. I've got a lovely Edwardian book about the life of Moses that, in very sort of typically Edwardian flowery language, just pictures the scene for us, the setting that we're in as we look at this passage. It's an ordinary morning, and the dawn is just breaking. The sun rises, and there's a dull haze. and we're at Mount Horeb. It's just emerging from the darkness, probably a cloudless sky, and long shadows are being cast across the ground. Moses, this shepherd of 40 years, is there at Mount Horeb, and the sheep, I suppose, are sort of scattered around, bleating or sleeping, or nibbling some herbs and grass. There's the occasional rustle of insect life in the bush, and that kind of thing. And it's all very much a normal day for Moses, but then suddenly this bush bursts into flame. And instead of being consumed, it continues to flame and to flame and to burn and to burn throughout the encounter that Moses has in this chapter. It burns and goes on burning. It is an emblem of deity. It is a revelation of God as he speaks. The angel of the Lord speaks to Moses. The voice that came from a bush, like a double knock. Moses, Moses, God says. And what follows is this dialogue. It's all a dialogue between God and the man Moses. God calls, Moses answers. God speaks again, Moses questions. God answers plentifully, and on it goes. The whole conversation taking place as this bush burns and burns, but doesn't burn out. And the first thing Moses, having addressed him, is there in verse 5. Do just look at verse 5 before we move to our first heading. This is such an important observation to make by way of introduction. Verse 5, do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. Even our man Moses cannot come near because he is a sinner and because God is holy. The holy God is a consuming fire. The bush may not be burning up, but God is a consuming fire. He is inapproachably holy. He is utterly and totally pure, and his presence cannot endure sin. And one of the great lessons that we will learn as Christians, if we will read Exodus, is the desperate need we have for a rescue from sin, to be atoned for. And of course, it is a presumption in our modern world that we will saunter into the presence of God when we die, that we'll just sort of turn up in heaven and be able to bear the presence of God as we are. In order to meet with God, to know God, to enjoy his presence, we must have sin dealt with. This is a big lesson of Exodus, and this, of course, is a point of Christianity, a point of the cross, the great exchange where the Son of God, spotless as he was, bears the judgment for our sin, which goes to him, whilst, on the other hand, his perfect holiness and righteousness is given to us, all by faith. So that the holy God can become our God and we can know his presence. Well, that brings us to our first point, the ever-present God. So here is this fire, it burns without ceasing. And of course, if you know the story of Exodus and cast your minds forwards, you'll remember what happens when the people leave Egypt and go into the wilderness. God is with them in a pillar of cloud by day and in a pillar of fire by night. Here is the presence of God with his people at this stage, symbolized by this fire, this bush. He is ever present with his people. And we don't just mean omnipresent, that God is everywhere. That is, of course, true. What we mean is he's actively, personally involved with his people. The God who appears to Moses and speaks to Moses says, if you look with me at in verse 7, it's an astonishing thing, isn't it, what he says. Verse 7, I have surely seen the affliction of my people. And he says, I have heard their cry. Now, we're not Moses and we're not Israel, but we are God's people. And believe it, his eyes are upon you and his ears are open to your prayers. He is the ever-present God. Perhaps most precious of all is what God goes on to say in verse 7. I know their sufferings. He really does. Whatever they may be. And however absent God may feel in the midst of the darkest sufferings, Behind a frowning providence hides a smiling face. God is ever present. Verse 8, God says, I have come down to deliver them. So here is the God of the Bible, the only, the real, the eternal God who made us. He is there and he's personal and he's ever present. He sees and knows and hears and answers. It's a precious reality, perhaps especially for those times when you do face suffering in your own life. Here are truths to treasure up. They must have been precious truths for Israel. Remember their circumstances. They've been in Egypt now for over 400 years. And for most of that time, they had been slaves. God had promised them this great land. That he promised that they'd become a great people. They have become a great people, but they are not in the land. They are enslaved. And so when they hear the news of a God who knows them and sees them and is going to deliver them, well, this is what they say. You might want to turn there. Chapter 4 and verse 31. Chapter 4 and verse 31. It's the end of this kind of section. It's a wonderful image. The people believed, and when they heard that the Lord had visited the people of Israel and that he'd seen their affliction, they bowed their heads and worshipped. Just consider again what news this must have been for them after 400 years of silence. I've got an office at the church I work at called St. Nick's. And it's also a creche. That's where my office is, in the creche. And that means there are a few books on my bookshelves that I'm actually able to understand and comprehend. This is one of them. And it's one of the best in the creche, actually, God's the Big Picture Story Bible. And right in the middle of this sort of summary of the whole story of the Bible is one of my favorite sections, favorite chapters, that deals with that period between when the prophets stopped speaking and when Jesus came. And of course, it was 400 years as well, wasn't it? 400 years of silence, and this chapter talks about that. 400 years of silence. The people knew nothing. God said nothing. Silence. And then once again, God spoke. And that was Israel in Egypt. Silence for centuries. Can you imagine that? Where is God? You can only assume that the vast majority of the people must have assumed that the God who'd spoken to their forefathers wasn't really there. Even the most mature of believers among Israel must have asked those sorts of questions. But God was there. He had seen them. He had heard them. And now he had come down to deliver them. I was at a conference a few weeks ago now, and I picked up a book. It was a conference up in Leeds called Renew, and it was about how you sort of bring children up in a screen-saturated world. And I discovered a word I'd not heard before. I'm sure you are much more in touch with what's going on. I've heard of it already. But it's called fubbing. Has anyone heard of fubbing? Okay, well, there you go. I'm ahead of the curve. Fubbing is where you're with someone, but you're not really with them, because actually you're on your phone. And we've all had that experience. In fact, we all do it to other people all the time. You're sort of there in their presence, but you're not really present because your eyes are not open to them, your ears are not really open to them, you are on your phone. And I suppose Israel may have felt that way about God. Well, I suppose he's there, he's omnipresent. I suppose he exists, but perhaps he's just on his phone. And he doesn't really care. And he's not really personal or involved or there. And if only he knew what was going on. But then comes this stunning, breathtaking revelation. I see you, I hear you, and I've come down to deliver you. So here is a precious truth for the Christian. Let me quote a song that is one that I've been enjoying singing recently. The night is dark, and it will be. For you at various points in your life, definitely. The night is dark, but I am not forsaken. For by my side, the Savior, he will stay. So I labor on in weakness and rejoicing, for in my need his power is displayed. So this I hold, my shepherd will defend me. Through the deepest valley he will lead. The night has been won, I shall overcome, yet not I, but through Christ in me, the ever-present God. So, this applies obviously to you at certain times. Perhaps right now it's a precious truth for you, but it will apply to others as well. It might be, if you go to an Anglican church, it might be that at the moment your vicar is contemplating writing to his bishop, because the House of Bishops are just on the verge of potentially deciding to propose great changes to the Church of England, which will bring the Church of England into a very dark place. And it's a courageous thing for a vicar to write to their bishop and to urge them to stand for truth. But you can say to them, if they are, as they write with trembling hands, God is with you. And not only is God with them, but he will always make a way for his people. He will always be enough for his people, no matter what our actions might result in, no matter what the consequences may be, God will be sufficient. That is our second heading as we close, the all-sufficient God. Here he is, he's speaking to Moses, and look at what he says in verse 10. Can you imagine hearing this? Verse 10, come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Come on, Moses. You are going to emancipate an entire nation from one of the world's most powerful people. It's an extraordinary thing to be told. And of course, we're not Moses again, so we need to be careful how we apply this. But you can imagine how Moses must have felt. This huge, momentous moment in his life. Nothing is going to be the same again at this stage. Everything will be different. The task before him is an immovable mountain. And in response, understandably, he cries out, who am I? Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? What? Who? Me? No, I don't have it in me. Who am I? In his youth, you may know, Moses did think of himself as something of a savior, but experience has taught him that he's not. He doesn't have it in him. But God does, and that is what is revealed to him. Moses knows his inadequacy as an old man now, insufficient for the task, but God is all sufficient. And many of us, as we just live the Christian life, or try to engage in ministry, you know, even in the sort of workplace context, as we try and have a vision for ministry and to bring the gospel to the city, we feel utterly inadequate, utterly weak, all the time, basically. Or perhaps that's just me. But we have an all-sufficient God. And that is what Moses has to what Moses learns. Look at verse 12. In reply to Moses, God says, verse 12, yes, Moses, but I will be with you. And the great lesson, I suppose, of this account is this. If we have God, which we do, then we have everything we need. Whatever you're engaged in as a Christian, as you seek to live the Christian life, serve the Lord in the tasks he's given you, the circumstances he's put you. If you have God, you have everything you need. As you seek to keep going to the end, you have everything you need if you have God. God will meet Moses' inadequacy with his own sufficiency. The word sufficient meaning enough. God is enough. God is like a great fire that doesn't burn up. We are like a match. So here are some matches. I hope I don't set any fire alarms off as I give you a little visual illustration, but this is us, isn't it? We are like this flame, soon to expire. And I'm not sure how long to leave it, but you get the idea. We're dust. We're mortal. We're human. But God is eternal. He is like this bush that doesn't burn up. He is all sufficient. In him, we have everything we need. And that is the great lesson of this chapter. I was reading about Charles Spurgeon, who you may hear about most weeks if I'm preaching. Great preacher down the road at Elephant and Castle. And after one day of very, very busy ministry, he felt totally drained and exhausted and weak. And as he got into, he had, I don't know what they used back then, you know, horse and trap or something like that. He sort of slumped into his chair, feeling rather sorry for himself and depressed, until this verse, "My grace is sufficient for thee," came to him. And he immediately compared himself to a little fish in the Thames as he was driving past the Thames. He imagined this fish apprehensive lest drinking so many pints of water in the river each day, it might drink the Thames dry. And hearing Father Thames say to it, "Drink away, little fish, my stream is sufficient for thee." God will always meet our need. We have everything we need in him. His grace is sufficient for us. Here was Moses, he had a question. "If I go to the people and they say, 'Who sent me?' what shall I say?" And God supplies the need. He gives him an answer. And in that answer, again, we see the all-sufficient God. Look at what is God's name there as he reveals it. "I am who I am." Go to the people and say, "I am," has sent you. Moses has just said, "Who am I that I should complete this task?" God's reply, "I am." He will meet the needs. It is a name that immediately tells us lots about God. He's self-defining and all-sufficient. But at the same time is a name that is baffling and one which we will never fully plumb the depths of and comprehend, because in this sense, God is too much for us. He is too much for us because he is God and we are human. But that is a good thing because it means in him we have everything we need. And so in your Christian life, don't let your time with God in prayer be too infrequent. Come quickly to him, the all-sufficient God.